You are listening to This Week in Palestine. I'm your host, Ann Lucas. Sabah al-khair, masa al-khair, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. You are listening to This Week in Palestine, and I'm your host, Ann Lucas. I'm recording this after Israel's bombing of Iran, and I'm very aware there are two different ideas about what may be going on regarding Israel's expansion of the war. One is, Israel actually wants to expand the war. The other is that Israel is using its adventurism to distract observers from what is going on in Gaza. I personally believe the latter, especially given the atrocities upon atrocities we've been seeing in northern Gaza in this past week. For that reason, what I'm sharing today is a discussion with Michael Fakhri. Michael is the UN Special Rapporteur on the Right to Food, and last week he released a report on the starvation and famine situation in Gaza. I had marked my calendar for when he was going to release this report. Unfortunately, the Kevorkian Center at NYU also had an event scheduled to discuss his report as soon as it was released. What we'll hear in this show is Michael explaining who and what he is, as well as his findings on the starvation and famine in Gaza. And then we will hear from two other different scholars expounding on what Michael Fakhri's report means in relation to the ethics of war in international law. So after Michael, we will first hear from Asli Bali from Yale Law School. Professor Bali is a prominent scholar of human rights law and the international security order. After her, we will hear from Adil Haq from Rutgers University Law School. His research is on the ethics of armed conflict and the philosophy of international law. I apologize because the live audio from Michael and Adil is less than optimal, but the content is interesting and insightful, and all of the speakers are very engaging. We have a lot to listen to, so yalla bina, let's go.
Hi. I'll just quickly explain what is a UN Special Rapporteur, and then I'll get right to it. So UN Special Rapporteur is an independent expert with the UN. There are over 40 mandates, minus food, there's water, housing, freedom of expression. We are independent, we are unpaid, we are not the UN. Our mandate comes from the Human Rights Council. Another way to think about it is we're the eyes, ears, and good conscience of the UN system. And the way I imagine my job is to learn. I talk to everybody. And the reason I decided to do this is two reasons. One, Vasuki is an old friend and old comrade. She's also, I think of her as one of the aunties of my son and of third world approaches to international law. So we're in the same movement of TWAIL, third world approaches to international law. And there was a conference, a TWAIL conference in Cairo, and there's this idea of, well, we have to do more. What does doing more even mean? And there was an older scholar, George Abisab, from a previous generation. And his keynote was entitled Behind Enemy Lines. You know, he was on the World Trade Organization appellate body. He was on all these fancy institutions. And he imagined himself, as he described as, behind enemy lines. And for me, that made perfect sense. I've always felt I'm a double agent. This accent cost my parents a lot of money. Hi, I'm Michael. That's currency to it. I'm acutely aware. And I get to choose how I introduce myself. Not everyone from my family or from my country can do that. So I'm a double agent. But in this job, I revealed myself. Ha ha! I'm as well as it's going to get, I think. And so the political reason I chose to do this and to go behind enemy lines and to engage in institutional spaces is very specific to the right to food itself. Because the right to food is one of the most radical tools available because it's been taken up by social movements, by the food sovereignty movement, and more accurately, food sovereignty movements in the plural, by labor unions as well, by indigenous peoples. And they sometimes work together in solidarity. So the right to food is powerful because it is in the hands of the people. And they have the same ambivalence we do as Twailers, which is you are limited by the tools sometimes that you have. So make sure that your political strategy is not defined by the tools you use, such as international law. When we carry that ambivalence, if not sometimes the ability to drop that tool and use something else. Today I'm human rights. 10 years ago I was trade. In 15 years, who knows what I'm going to do. That's what I do, what I do. So also, what I always tell social movements is I hold the mandate, right? So I'm only as strong as the social movements. The more powerful they are, the more radical I can be with this one foot in, one foot out, this inside-outside strategy in these institutional spaces. But similarly, I'm only as clever as my friends and comrades who are all here today, who I learn from, who inspire me, who I take their work and mangle it, make it my own. So I wouldn't be able to do this work and do this report if I didn't know, if I didn't learn from them, but also if I didn't know that they had my back. This type of work, you need to know that someone has your back. And it allows me to not even think twice about people. Are you afraid of what? I have comrades. I'll be fine. So I'm just really honored and grateful to have this panel here today. So let me get right to it. So how does one tell the story of genocide while it's happening in real time? That was the question. It's not a new question, especially around Palestine. It's not a new question for most people. How is it that people immediately recognize that what's happening over the last year is genocide? Millions of people marching in the street, not just demanding the end of war, but end of genocide. It's because genocide is experienced more commonly than the law recognizes. And it's happening in real time to more people than the law recognizes. People saw themselves immediately in the struggle. And so in this report, there's nothing I do that's new as such. There's no time. I don't have the resources to produce new knowledge as such. I'm not a facts and figures sort of person, but I can put them together. The challenge I put to myself was, how do I tell this story? And how we tell this story is just as important as what is the story. You can't separate the two. And one way, it was not just the story of genocide, and it's not just the story of resistance, but what is the story of building a new future? That's the challenge that I put to myself. One way I did it is I called up my friend Omar Khoury, who's right there. There he is. We told the story through graphics, through illustrations, through comics. Because, you know, you can do so much with words. You can do something very different. And he's an old friend from childhood. We play Dungeons and Dragons together. We read comics together. We hang out. What's your methodology? I hang out with friends and comrades. That's my methodology. And interestingly, if you read the report, you've already read the report, there's very so-called controversial arguments being made here. We got the most pushback we got is on the comics. People at very different levels within the United Nations from all facets were either passionate to support us or fought tooth and nail to make sure it didn't happen. They didn't say, no, there's no genocide. They didn't say, your arguments are on starvation are weak. There was no engagement on the substance of all the arguments that are in this report. They didn't say, how can you identify Palestine as a territory? That's a thing that we can still talk about today. They didn't say, how is it that you're challenging Zionism by focusing on food? Those are all tough topics to discuss. They said, no, you can't have comics in a UN report. So that told me we're doing something right. Mm-hmm. And that we should all be working with artists and different media and different forms. What would it mean to do a report with sound? I don't know. It means you can engage more people. It means you can think differently and imagine it's not just about depicting horror, but imagining fundamentally different futures that are practical and realistic. That's what's at stake behind the comic. One thing that then I thought through is, well, this isn't new, and famine just doesn't happen. So a common way that people in the UN and in international law and in the news talk about famine and starvation is as a natural phenomenon. In English, we have two words. Not all languages have the verb to starve. And then famine, the state of being description. Famine, there's no subject. It happens. You can't famine someone. You starve someone. So famine is treated as a natural phenomenon. In international law, it's treated primarily as a war crime. And it's a war crime, something you can, through the International Criminal Court, something you can only go after individuals, bad people, bad guys, usually gendered for a reason. That's not how famine happens. So first thing that I do in the report is I reframe what is famine. First, famine is always created by humans. It is always by design. It is always manufactured. Meaning first, famine is always political. It's a choice people make. It is the result of institutions. That also means that famine is always predictable and preventable. Second, famine is structural. It's built into the food system. And it's a process that's usually a process of slow violence. You can see it coming. So rather than using a question, the way people measure famine now is a body count. So rather than measuring graves as a way to determine is there famine, what I suggest is, well, if you look at, let's frame it in human rights terms, human rights violation, gender-based violence, exploitation of workers, land grabs. If you're starting to see that systemically and at an increasing rate, that's telling you that you're getting closer and closer to famine. So famine is political, famine is structural, a result of slow violence. When famine hits, then it lasts. So third, famine is long-lasting. It affects your body as an individual. If you survive forever, it will always affect your health mentally and physically. More and more research is showing that it affects how you transmit your genes. So the children, that if you decide to have children, or if you have children, the fact that you experience famine will affect how your genes are transmitted to your children. You will pass on something, still not sure what. And there is the social trauma of famine. Famine echoes into the future through generations. It's very difficult to talk about famine because there's a profound degree of shame of the experience. This I learned from talking to people from Ireland. There's very few memorials to famine. Because if you survive famine, these are the choices that you have to make. Who do I feed? And what's the corollary to who do I feed? Who do I allow to die? Your neighbor knocks on your door. Do you give them rice or do you turn them away? And then you both survive. You have two children. You have seven children. Who do you feed? What do you feed them? Knowing the results of your choice and living through the experience of that choice, it's very difficult to talk about family when you survive it. That trauma, you carry it, you pass it along. So it's long lasting. And then it's always international. One reason it's really hard to stop or prevent famine is every major power, every permanent member of the Security Council, every rich country, directly or indirectly, has supported a starvation campaign today. The United States supports Israel. Russia allowed Azerbaijan to starve and ethnically cleanse the Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh. It's not like the U.S. and Russia are friends, but what they all agree on, the P5, the rich countries in the Gulf, is they all agree, let's just keep starvation as a tool that we all want to use. That's what we're up against. That's what we're up against. More specifically now to Palestine. The question I answer is, how did Israel starve so many people so quickly and so completely? 2.3 million people. We've never seen this degree of speed in modern history. It's because Israel has been using food as a weapon since it was created in 1948. With the creation of Israel, there is an immediate concern of starvation. If you look at the United Nations Relief and Work Agency for Palestinians, UNRWA, if you look at its founding documents in late 40s, early 50s, I should know this here, there's an immediate concern for starvation from the beginning. Starvation is not just the denial of humanitarian aid. It is the destruction of a food system. It is the erasure of people from the land. It is the destroying of olive trees. Olive trees are not just a livelihood. It is people's connection to their ancestors and to the future. Olive trees live thousands of years. Olive trees are older than most of our countries. They are the result of choices of ancestors, and how we take care of them today is our choice of how we are taking our kin into the future. So that's what's at stake. That's how Israel was able to do it more and more. So I look at Gaza, I look at the political economy, I look at the blockade and siege that started in 2000, but I look at the history of Palestine and Israel itself, framing in terms of the so-called question of Palestine, which is as old, if not older, than the United Nations itself. It is one of the core issues. And the way it's been asked in the past is, there's this territory called Palestine. Who is to govern? And at different moments, it's some variation of a Jewish state and an Arab state. Every time there's some variation, there's always the subordination of the Arab state and the Palestinian people to the Jewish state, starting from the 40s till now. And every time, food and the food system and agriculture and the relationship to land is at the heart of the matter. So the other thing I do in the report then is take on the question of Palestine by focusing on food. Whenever there's a starvation campaign, what's at stake is territory. Starvation is always used as a way to displace people for the purpose of control or occupation of territory. That's what's going on in Palestine and everywhere else. So what's interesting to me now, you've heard it, you're going to hear it again in the UN. One state solution, two state solution, this is a distraction and a waste of time. We need to go back to the question of, there is a territory of Palestine. Who is to govern? And remember that the Palestinian people have a right to return to Palestine. So now we add another layer. Return to what? What kind of Palestine? One that has been burned to the ground, filled with poison, of rubble and horror. What's forgotten is this right of return. Whatever political variation, state, federation, whatever, I think it's important to bring it back to, there is a territory called Palestine and the Palestinian people have a right to it. So what's been challenging, what's been impossible is telling the story. It's bits and pieces. But what's also encouraging, just as we're in this moment of profound horror, and where Israel announced its intent to starve the Palestinian people on October 9th, then it did, and now we're seeing the effects with potentially no repercussions. Except we're also at a historical moment where we've never seen this degree of solidarity for the Palestinian people. I've never seen or read this degree of movements coming together to support Palestinian people, to support their human rights, to support the right of return, demanding liberation, resistance. This is the language now, not just human rights. So it's also drawing from a human rights tradition of liberation and resistance. It's changing the nature of human rights itself. We're watching, different than the war in Iraq and different than other wars, the United States and Israel exiting from international law. They're not even trying to make broad international law arguments anymore. Leaving us then to use international law in more radical ways, potentially. So it's a profound moment of solidarity as well. People marching in the streets. Every UN institution is in an existential moment. How the UN in its multiplicity, not the UN, all the different bits and pieces of the UN responds to Palestine today will determine the future of international law and global governance. Because what's at stake is, of course, the Palestinian people's liberation. What's also at stake is U.S. geopolitical power and the unity of Europe itself. Germany on one side, and Spain and the Irish on the other, to give you just the rough spectrum. So what are people saying when they're marching in the streets? I never thought I'd hear it. They're saying, from the river to the sea, Palestine will be free. Okay, what's that mean? It takes us to this notion of freedom. Let me take you to the right to food, back to where I started. What does the right to food mean? It means, you look in the treaty, freedom from hunger. What are the causes of hunger? It means, how do we know we're free? Freedom from oppression, occupation, and exploitation. That's it. I look forward to our conversation. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for having me, and apologies for being the one who is looming over you probably on a very large screen. I could not be more honored to be included in this panel, and I'm just so sorry that I was not able to travel to New York for it because of my teaching schedule. But it's a great pleasure, and especially now that folks have moved to the front row, I can actually see Michael in his bright sweater and cheerful smile, and I can also see you, Adel, and so it's a pleasure actually to be in your presence, however virtually. I thought I would take the opportunity of the panel to reflect a little bit on the role that Michael is playing in this report, and then also more generally how it fits into the sort of international landscape that we have available in a moment in which, as he mentioned and as Zeina so eloquently described, we are watching genocide unfolding in real time. So the first thing I would say is that in his role as a special rapporteur on the right to food, Michael has effectively transformed himself into the world's conscience on questions of famine and starvation. And this was not always the case. So this role was previously inhabited also by a fellow traveler of toil who labored mightily to address the many ways in which the right to food is compromised that Michael touched upon at the end of his talk today, the ways in which freedom from hunger are connected to the freedoms of self-determination, the freedom of food sovereignty, the freedom of the ability to feed yourself and your family, to preserve your culture. And his predecessor in this role identified many of these and other rights in a variety of settings, but they were not settings against which all of the violence, repression, all the spectacular elements of what we have been witnessing over the last 13 months in Gaza placed in relief this question of serving as a conscience on the issue of starvation. And Michael, as Basuki said in her introduction, was really the person we needed in this moment because he has already made clear in his previous work and including in his previous work in this role, but also just in his own work, the ways in which we have to connect the language of famine and its antiseptic sort of presentation to deliberate political choices, that famine, just as the right to food entails a set of freedoms that to which it is inalienably connected, so too the deprivation of that right is directly related to the very forms of international interaction with which toil has been most engaged: alien and colonial domination, foreign occupation, racial discrimination, apartheid, neocolonialism. These are all the political choices that are essentially obscured when we focus exclusively on either economic or ecological causes of famine. And the other thing that gets obscured, and the thing that Michael's work has made so clear and so inescapable, is the effort that other international law is deployed for to obscure the intentionality of starvation, of imposing conditions that are known are clearly going to induce the severity and scale of food insecurity to bring on malnutrition and starvation, which Michael has rightly identified as forms of individual and collective torture. This, of course, is incredibly important at this moment to reveal these dynamics because we are in a real kinetic conflict, of course, and Adel will have much to tell us about the laws that apply in an armed conflict situation like the one unfolding in Gaza. But this is also a conflict about truth and untruth, about fact-finding in an environment that is absolutely rife with distortion, diversion, dissembling, and cutting through the language of euphemisms and misdirection and propaganda by which we are presented with a vista of 2.3 million people being deliberately starved, even as we're told not to believe our lying eyes, requires that we have fact finders of incredible integrity, able to not just cut through the language that is conscripted to misdirect, but also to provide the rigorous research that captures realities, even realities that, as Michael has admirably shown us, words alone cannot convey. Why are parties set on delegitimizing the United Nations? Why do they target its personnel? Why do they seek to shut down its agencies? Because precisely the war on truth cannot be won in a battlefield where there are third-party arbiters that are actually returning to the field, engaging in meaningful fact-finding, and setting forth, having applied the strongest standards, having triangulated the information that is available, and providing for us a full portrait of what it is that we are actually seeing. The finding of genocide, and he began by noting the uses of genocide and their breadth beyond international law, but the finding of genocide in international law and the ways in which the International Court of Justice has been confronted with this question are predicated on facts. We cannot come to these findings without knowing the facts. And more specifically, the particular finding in the case of the International Court of Justice determination that there is a plausible case to be made here that the rights of Gazan civilians, the rights of Palestinians are being, the right to be protected from genocide is being violated, are tied to A, the deliberate decision to cause conditions of life that will physically destroy the group in whole or in part, and second, incitement to genocide. And what we see in what has been detailed and chronicled in Michael's report is precisely the empirical record we need to ascertain the presence of these conditions. We are now surrounded by fresh descriptions from North Gaza that Israel may be setting out to implement a plan to starve the civilian population by cutting them off from access to water and food in the immediate moment in order to bring about either their flight, 400,000 people under evacuation orders to give up their land, or to simply exterminate, to deprive them of the conditions necessary to sustain their lives. This is one moment, one day in 13 months that have unfolded in which every day we're witnessing some new evacuation order or policy designed to limit or close off altogether access to the basic means for humanitarian survival to this population. But because we're awash in an environment that sanitizes this information, that buries it under an avalanche of other extraneous facts that we need not focus on, since there can be no justification ever for genocide. But because we live in an information environment that does, in fact, obscure these facts through this avalanche of diversionary frameworks and descriptions, we are unable to bring together the cumulative account of what this adds up to without the work of precisely somebody like Michael. And what Michael has done is provide us with the empirical basis necessary for the ICJ to draw its conclusions, for the ICC prosecutor to proceed with his request for arrest warrants on the basis, again, of starvation, deprivation of the basic means required to avoid the physical destruction of the group that has been deprived of access to food, water, and humanitarian supplies. And he has also documented for us the empirical record against which we can think about the events in Gaza in relative terms, that is to say, in comparative context. He's provided for us the text against which the word so often used in the context of Gaza to the point of being emptied of meaning, the word unprecedented, regains its force. Because we can see the speed and scale of the infliction of malnutrition and starvation on 2.3 million people, the majority of whom are children, through the documentation he has provided. And he offers the kind of clarity that both international courts and, frankly, governments around the world have systematically avoided. He gives voice to what we have all witnessed and provides the record to document exactly how we can connect this set of empirical facts, the fact-finding he has done, to the international legal frameworks that make accountability possible. In telling us the reasons that the right to food is also a right to freedom from hunger, a right to self-determination, a right to sovereignty, a right to provide for and feed oneself, one's community, one's culture, he reveals to us the many dimensions of the crime of starvation that go well beyond deprivation of merely a set of material resources. Instead, he points us in the direction of the cultural genocide that is also present here and the intergenerational harms that flow from these crimes and that will continue to mark all those who survive them. The ways, as he puts it, that starvation works its way into the genetics of its survivors. All of this is what Michael's report literally does, and that already is invaluable. But it also takes its place in a broader landscape. I have already touched upon the ways in which the report expands beyond the half measures that courts have so far provided, let alone what governments have been willing to acknowledge explicitly. He has also provided reports that reinforce the efforts and positions taken by humanitarian agencies that are struggling to try to meet the moment by providing the very access to food, water, and humanitarian assistance, urgent medical, essential medical supplies that are being systematically excluded from Gaza. But he also showcases what independent experts can do that standing intergovernmental mechanisms cannot. The independent expert role, one that was innovated largely by the Human Rights Council in this iteration since 2006, is a role that is not answerable to a specific government and its foreign policies, but is also not hostage to the internal politics of international organizations, the fact that they're repeat players dependent upon governments, that they have to preserve their own institutional positions in a variety of ways that limit or constrain their ability to bear witness meaningfully. An independent expert, particularly one with the ferocious independence of Michael Fakhri, can impose standards that withstand the attempts to politicize facts and can draw on a variety of interdisciplinary mechanisms for conveying the knowledge that he has produced. The multimedia techniques that he has deployed in this report are, of course, themselves unprecedented, as he described in his presentation. They meet with resistance from the bureaucracy of the standing organization, but he was able to overcome that resistance and provide for us a text that exceeds what can be conveyed in words in a way that breaks through what has become the kind of deafening denialism with which we are surrounded if we live in a country like this one that has been so complicit in both failing to prevent and actively enabling genocide. Michael has also worked diligently to mobilize the collectivity of other independent experts that have amplified his findings and have also focused on the implications of their collective work. I just thought I would canvass a number of the joint statements that have been made by 30 or more experts at a time in the last 3 months or so. The most recent of which was, and Michael, correct me if I've missed something, but I believe on the 11th of October, noting that international order itself is breaking down in Gaza as UN experts marked 1 year of genocidal attacks on Palestinians, explicitly using the language of genocidal attacks from their positions as experts that have been endowed with the authority to oversee the normative and thematic scope of their mandates by states. So this is an important fact in and of itself, the naming, proper naming, something that courts and states have been reluctant to do. Another one just 4 days earlier, on the 7th of October, 35 UN experts called for an end of violence and accountability after a year of human loss and suffering and blatant disregard for international law. The ability to marshal his own work and that of his colleagues to demand something that the international community has been so resistant to providing, accountability, and not just for this human loss and suffering of the last year, but for the cumulative impact of 75 years of systematic imposition of human loss and suffering. In September, mid-September, UN experts warn international order on a knife's edge and urge states to comply with the International Court of Justice's advisory opinion. Here we see the ways in which independent experts are able to join this landscape to amplify the work of standing institutions when they finally rise to the occasion and use their authority and their platform, as the International Court of Justice did in its advisory opinion, to name the illegality of the practices we're witnessing. In August, Israel's escalating use of torture against Palestinians in custody, a preventable crime against humanity. Crime against humanity, another important defined term that has not yet reached the level of currency it should do in international organizations and at international courts, but that is mobilized by independent experts, Michael and his colleagues, in the service of providing a legal framework for understanding what it is that we're witnessing. And I could go on. I'm going to stop here to note that, in my view, the work of independent experts like Michael, who have been authorized by the Human Rights Council, actually reminds us of the degree to which this unenchanted palace at the United Nations can nonetheless, as Vasuki indicated in her opening comments, serve as a forum, a site for solidaristic collective action in defense of basic humanitarian values when geopolitical considerations paralyze the executive organs of the UN machinery. We should not look to the UN Security Council. We should not look to standing organizations. We can look to the conscience of the organization and of the international community, led by the Human Rights Council's independent experts, and affording the space to be politically leveraged by the General Assembly and others that are sites of solidarity in which member states willing to acknowledge what we're seeing seek to use international fora for the purposes of both protection and for restoring the freedoms that have been so grotesquely stamped out in Gaza, again, as Michael's report makes clear. For my money, the United Nations has, over the last 13 months, regained some portion of its damaged legitimacy as a forum for solidarity, even as, or perhaps because, its security organ, the UN Security Council, has come to lose its relevance in a moment in which it has been so badly disabled. It is the isolation that the United States and Israel face in the United Nations that is a measure of its capacity to actually reflect the broader international conscience that Michael Fakhri gives voice to. Ethnic cleansing, mass dislocation of a population from its homeland, extermination of civilians on an industrial scale using artificial intelligence. What we are witnessing today are the wages of incomplete decolonization, the deprivation of the basic right to self-determination, and watching it all in real time, supercharged with genocidal and apparently, at a minimum, cleansing, if not exterminationist logic. As we watch this, we are also seeing brought back a kind of solidarity that once rose to the occasion of addressing incomplete decolonization. And as it emerges, and as we witness the deepening isolation of the United States and Israel, perhaps to grow even deeper following the impending election in this country, as global opinion shifts decisively in the direction charted by Michael's report, the question becomes whether the United Nations or a different forum in its wake can channel the views of the overwhelming mass of humanity on this planet in a way that translates into effective, protective action, the solidaristic, collective voice that Michael has brought to us in this forum. I hope very much that we can all agree with the line that Vasuki started us with: don't accept the things you cannot change, change the things you cannot accept. And it's in that spirit that I really want to thank Michael for the incredible work he's done in his role as Special Rapporteur. I very much hope whoever succeeds you is able to fill those giant shoes. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. Great to be part of this conversation. I've been asked to assume a different role in this conversation and just walk you through the role of starvation in three important legal processes that remain ongoing. The first is the arrest warrant request proceedings at the International Criminal Court. Second is South Africa's case against Israel under the Genocide Convention at the International Court of Justice. And the third is sort of the somewhat opaque world of arms transfer law by the United Kingdom and the United States. I'm going to try to trace the role of starvation through these. So as many of you know, on May 20th, the prosecutor of the International Criminal Court announced that he had requested warrants for the arrest of three Hamas leaders and two Israeli leaders, Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant. The charges against Netanyahu and Gallant all revolve around the war crime of starvation, intentionally using starvation as a method of warfare. The prosecutor alleges that Netanyahu and Gallant ordered or failed to prevent intentional and systematic deprivation of objects indispensable to the human survival of a civilian population, attacks on civilians, including those queuing for food, and attacks on and killing of aid workers, which forced many agencies to cease or limit their operations in Gaza. His charges were agreed upon not only by the Office of the Prosecutor, but also by a distinguished panel of experts that the prosecutor assembled to provide an extra layer of critical scrutiny on work. According to the prosecutor, these acts were committed as part of a common plan to use starvation as a method of war and other acts of violence against the Gazan civilian population as a means to achieve three goals. First, to eliminate Hamas. Second, to secure the release of the hostages, which Hamas had abducted. And third, to collectively punish the civilian population of Gaza, whom they perceived as a threat to Israel. The prosecutor's evidence mostly relies on statements and actions by Israeli officials themselves. But given the audience here and our own location, I'll focus on statements by U.S. officials, which confirm the prosecutor's theory of the case. So first, in last year's State of the Union address, President Biden on television said that, quote, humanitarian assistance cannot be a bargaining chip, which rather strongly indicates that Israel has been using humanitarian assistance as a bargaining chip as a way to pressure Hamas to release hostages that remain in captivity. In addition, Brent McGurk, Biden's chief Middle East advisor, said last year that Israel would allow more humanitarian aid into Gaza if Hamas releases more hostages. And finally, The Atlantic recently reported that Prime Minister Netanyahu told Secretary of State Anthony Blinken to his face personally that he could not allow more humanitarian aid into Gaza because members of his cabinet wanted to collectively punish the civilian population of Gaza. I want to note one more thing because Michael noted the relationship, or not just the relationship, the kind of overarching role of the occupation and the starvation of Gaza. I just want to note that the occupation plays a very important but rather subtle and somewhat technical role in the ICC prosecutor's case. In order to bring the war crime of starvation into play, the prosecutor has to show that the law of international armed conflict applies. And to do that, he has several theories, but one is that Gaza remains under Israeli occupation, and in particular, Israel's control over Gaza's borders and maritime space has allowed Israel to starve the civilian population of Gaza. And it is the same exercise of control that both establishes that Israel remains the occupying power in Gaza and is also the mechanism through which starvation is, at least in part, achieved. And this is crucial for the prosecutor's case. The charges also include the crimes against humanity of murder, extermination, other inhumane acts, and persecution. But all of these, again, circle around starvation because they all involve deaths and injuries resulting from or associated with the systematic deprivation of objects indispensable to the survival of Palestinian civilians in Gaza. Importantly, the starvation campaign and associated acts of violence involve the severe deprivation of victims' fundamental rights by reason of their identity as Palestinians, and therefore can be qualified as a crime against humanity of persecution. Crimes against humanity in general involve the widespread and systematic attack on a civilian population, just to underscore kind of the gravity of these charges. Now, the combination of persecution and extermination might sound equivalent to genocide. They're not. And some people criticize the prosecutor for not bringing genocide charges at this time. My own view is that the prosecutor intends to bring additional charges, including forced displacement and attacks on medical and food systems, before bringing genocide charges. But that all depends on the court actually issuing the arrest warrants based on the charges that have already been brought, and we've been waiting several months for that. So we will see. But this brings me to South Africa's case against Israel and the International Court of Justice, alleging violations of the Genocide Convention. As I'm sure most of you know, genocide involves the intent to destroy a group in whole or in substantial part. So South Africa alleges that Israel intends to destroy the Palestinians of Gaza as a substantial group of the Palestinians as a whole. While Israel is killing thousands of Palestinians with bombs and bullets, the heart of South Africa's case is that Israel is deliberately inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction as a form of genocide. through a combination of starvation, displacement, and systematic destruction of homes, hospitals, agricultural land, and food and water systems. And it is this combination of tactics and strategies that actually threatens the very existence of the Palestinians of Gaza as a group. And this is crucial to South Africa's case, both when it eventually reaches the merit stage, where it actually has to prove that Israel has committed genocide, but it's also been crucial in the preceding months during what's called the provisional measures process, where South Africa has repeatedly come to court, asking the court to order Israel to take measures now to safeguard the survival of Palestinian civilians in Gaza. This, if you look at the court's orders that they have issued, every time they center around humanitarian aid, and they just become more and more specific and blunt as time has gone on. It's also crucial to understand both for the failure, but also the partial success of South Africa's appeal to the court to simply order Israel to suspend its military operations in Gaza. South Africa's argument was that because Israel is inflicting starvation through its military campaign as a whole, the only way to safeguard and to preserve the civilian population is for the military campaign as a whole to stop. In other words, you can't isolate individual genocidal acts that Israel is committing in Gaza in order to stop those, but allow its military campaign to go forward, because the campaign as a whole is genocidal. And so the whole thing has to stop. And the one place where South Africa was successful was in appealing to the court to order Israel not to launch an offensive in Rafah. And again, the argument there was that because the civilian population was so reliant on Rafah, if they were expelled without adequate care for their provision, the result would be to compound their precarity and increase the risk of mass death through starvation and disease. So again, it's important to emphasize that the genocide claim is not just about the bombing campaign. It's about this combination of strategies and tactics that endanger the population as a whole. The last context I wanted to talk about was the arms transfer context, because as people living in the United States, this is something that we think about and talk about every day, that it's our government that is giving Israel the weapons that it's using to kill civilians on in large numbers in Gaza. But I want to start across the pond in the United Kingdom. So on September 2nd, the United Kingdom announced that it would suspend the transfer of 30 military items to Israel, including components for fighter aircraft, helicopters, and drones, as well as items that facilitate ground targeting that would be used to power them. So the UK did this according to, pursuant to its national law, its Export Control Act. The relevant legal standard says that having assessed the recipient country's attitude toward relevant principles established by instruments of international humanitarian law, the government will not grant a license if it determines that there's a clear risk that the items might be used to commit or facilitate serious violations of international humanitarian law. Now, you might assume that the UK found a pattern of unlawful attacks by the IDF, unlawful bombing of Palestinian civilians, either directed at them, or that were indiscriminate in nature, or that inflicted disproportionate harm on civilians. But that is actually not how the UK reached its decision. Instead, the UK found that Israel's compliance and commitment in the areas of humanitarian relief and treatment of detainees gave cause for concern about its attitude and approach to the conduct of hostilities. In other words, Israel's denial of food, medicine, and other essentials from entering Gaza indicated a general attitude of disrespect and contempt for IHO. And this attitude creates a clear risk that the IDF will also carry out unlawful attacks with UK military items. So put bluntly, if Israel is violating the most simple and straightforward obligations to allow food and medicine to reach civilians who need it, how can it be trusted to comply with its more complex legal obligation in the conduct of hostilities at the carrying out of this bombing campaign? Now, notably, the UK concluded that Israel has not fulfilled its duty as an occupying power to ensure to the fullest extent of the means available to it those supplies essential to the survival of the population in Gaza, and concluded that the level of aid remains insufficient. So in other words, Israel remains the occupying power in Gaza, and as such has affirmative obligations to actively prevent starvation and ensure the food and medical needs of the population. And so by willfully impeding humanitarian relief from reaching civilians, Israel is essentially committing a kind of double violation, because it is inflicting the very harm that it is duty-bound to prevent, and killing the very people that it is obligated to protect. It's a kind of compound violation. So unfortunately, Israel gets most of its weapons and other military items from us, from the United States. And the United States, the U.S. State Department has taken a very different approach. So ProPublica recently revealed both USAID and the State Department's Bureau of Population, Refugees, and Migration determined that Israel was blocking humanitarian aid and that our Foreign Assistance Act should be triggered to freeze almost $830 million earmarked for weapons and bombs to Israel. These agencies documented Israeli interference with aid efforts, including killing aid workers, raising agricultural structures, bombing ambulances and hospitals, sitting on supply depots, and routinely turning away trucks full of food and medicine. USAID reported that the looming famine in Gaza was the result of Israel's arbitrary denial, restriction, impediments to U.S. humanitarian assistance, and concluded that Gaza was one of the worst humanitarian catastrophes in the world. Despite all of this, on May 10th, Secretary of State Blinken certified to Congress that we do not currently assess that the Israeli government is prohibiting or otherwise restricting food and other essentials from reaching civilians in Gaza. So how is this possible? There are obvious answers that we can all think of. I want to identify two that might not be obvious. One is actually legal. So the United States is one of the few countries in the world that actually agrees with Israel that Israel is not the occupying power in Gaza. And therefore, from the U.S. perspective, Israel has no affirmative obligation to the civilian population of Gaza. It has a different obligation, a negative obligation, if you will, not to arbitrarily restrict access to humanitarian relief. And that term arbitrary, as you can imagine, is ambiguous enough that it creates room for evasion by those with an eye to evade. And it puts the focus not on what Israel should be doing, but on identifying specific acts that it should not be doing. And that changes the way the problem is framed. The other has to do with timing. And I wanted to bring this up because, as some of you may have seen, Secretary Blinken and Secretary Austin, the Secretary of Defense, have apparently sent Yael Gallant, the one whose arrest is sought by the SEC prosecutor, a strongly worded letter saying that Israel has 30 days to improve humanitarian access to Gaza or potentially fall afoul of the U.S. Foreign Assistance Act, in which case we would have to suspend arms transfers. That sounds like a positive development, and who knows, it may have a positive effect. But I do want to focus on something about timing. Secretary Blinken gave his last certification to Congress on May 10th. If you look at a chart of aid into Gaza, you'll see that April saw a spike of aid trucks allowed into Gaza, so right before Blinken gives a certification to Congress, and May, it plummets. And it's gone down every month since, and this month is the worst yet. So I hope we see an increase in humanitarian aid because lives are at stake. But I do think it's very important to watch what happens after the next certification of Israeli compliance is presumably given to allow arms transfers to continue, because based on past record, there's evidence of evasion, collusion, something that has left Palestinians just as vulnerable as they were before. With that, I will rejoin the Thank you very much.
We are out of time, but I wanted to remind you it takes a village to produce a show like This Week in Palestine. Special thanks to Mohammed Arul and Bob Funk, with additional thanks to Stan Robinson and Steve Lowe. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. Thank you for spending your time with us today as we continue to work towards Palestinian liberation. See you next week. Thank you.